Is Israel God's miracle, as many people believe? Or is it just something that the UN felt obligated to do after the Holocaust of the Second World War? First now, Bill, as we sit here in London, Israel seems at this very moment to be on the brink of war. Do you agree? Do you agree that that could very well be the case? And if you do, how so? Why?
I do believe that could be the case because all of the indicators in the news, the current events, are pointing toward war. I believe the days of diplomacy, unfortunately, have come and gone. Israel just recently celebrated its 62-year anniversary, and they're no longer, Israel's enemies are no longer lobbying. Right. That's a tongue twister. Protest stones against the Jews. They have high-tech arsenals that can decimate the Jewish state, and Israel is very concerned. It's never faced an existential threat as strong as it does today in all of its history. Mm-hmm. There are more rockets pointed at Tel Aviv than any other city in the world. So I think we have to look at those things and take them very seriously. And we can, it's not speculation. There are Bible prophecies that warned us that these types of events would come. So that's what I'm intrigued with.
Mm. So, if you're talking about wars that have a prophetic significance, to have an Israeli war, Israel has to be in the land to begin with, doesn't she? So, you must believe then that the state of Israel today is a fulfillment of Bible prophecy. Is it a fulfillment of Bible prophecy, or is it, as I said at the beginning of the program, is it just something the UN felt obligated to do after the horrors of the Holocaust, to give these people their own homeland?
Israel is a miracle of God. It exists today in fulfillment of Bible prophecy. And so many in the church, unfortunately, do think it is really nothing more than the obligation of the UN, United Nations, to help them after the Holocaust. But we have numerous prophecies in the Bible that foretold the time that the Jews would be regathered into the land. We were given very specific conditions throughout these prophecies. I'll give you just a few to explain. Ezekiel 36, verses 22 through 24, tells us that God is going to bring the Jews out from the nations of the world into the land. And he says it's not for their sake that he's doing this. It's for his holy name's sake. This means that they're going to be bringing the Jews into the land, not because they're doing something observable on the world scene that warranted that, but because it was for his holy name's sake. So they're going to come into Israel in a condition of unbelief. And as you know today, many Jews don't believe in Jesus. Many Jews don't even believe in Jehovah. They're all across the spectrum. So we get one detail there. We get another detail in Ezekiel 37, verses 11 and 12. Says, out from a horrific Holocaust-type condition where they feel their hope is cut off and they're being brought into the land from that condition, out from the nations of the world. Mm-hmm. Well, we know that's what happened after World War II with the Holocaust attempt. Yes. And then Isaiah 11:11 is a very important one to look at as well. It says that God would bring them out from the nations of the world into the land of Israel, and he says, a second time. Yeah. Well, if you search through the scriptures, you don't find a third, fourth, or fifth. So the second time is the last and final time. And so many of us believe this is that second time. So the prophecies alone do reference that God would bring them back into the land. The question is it this time, or is it going to be another dispersion and some subsequent time? Well, there's no third or fourth time. So this is the time. Now, in Ezekiel 36, I said God is going to uphold his holy name through his people Israel. We pick that up again in Ezekiel 39, verses 7. This is the episode of the Gog of Magog invasion where Russia and Iran and Turkey and Ethiopia and Libya, and there's 9 populations listed in total, that in the latter days will come to invade Israel to confiscate great booty and plunder. And and God destroys that invasion and protects his people Israel. And he says, I will uphold my holy name through my people Israel, and the nations shall know that I'm the Lord. So Israel today is a requirement for God to uphold his holy name so the nations will know that he's the Lord. It required Israel being brought back into the land so that this prophecy could find fulfillment. And this is a very critical time in history. And when Ezekiel 38 and 39 occurs and God upholds his holy name, it's at a pivotal time because it's important for humanity to realize that the God of the Jews is a promise keeper. and he's going to defeat an amazing invasion that's going to come against them. And it's going to be clear who defeated them. It's not going to be the Israeli Defense Forces. It's going to be God Jehovah. And shortly thereafter, because I believe it's a pre-tribulational event, humanity is going to be forced with a decision. How do they feel about Christ after God has demonstrated his might? Or do they buy into the Antichrist system whereby no one will be able to buy or sell unless they take a mark in their right hand or in their forehead, according to Revelation 13? And they're going to make a choice. Are you going to choose God or are you going to choose the system of the Antichrist? And so God is letting them know he's real and he's a promise keeper. And he's going to do that through, he says, my people Israel in Ezekiel 39, verse 7.
It's interesting you say that because many people, many Jews today, just as you have already said, just don't even believe in the Bible, their own book. And they look on us with disdain, like, you're idiots. Now, when I was in Jerusalem 2-3 years ago, we had an amazing, you could call it a God moment, when we actually were in the old city, looking across the plaza where the Western Wall is, up at the Temple Mount and the Dome of the Rock. And we bumped into a young Israeli lad and got chatting to him. And we were just out of the blue started witnessing to him. He was about 18, 19. His mother came along, tried to pull him away and to take him away. And she said, "What are you doing to him? What are you doing?" I said, "It's okay. So we're just chatting about the Bible." And she was immediately interested. "What about the Bible?" I said, "Well, it's your book. You know." "No, what are you talking about?" So to actually be standing there, Bill, with this Jewish couple in the old city, and we were talking to them about Daniel, about the coming wars, about the Antichrist and the coming temple, and to be standing there talking to this woman and then looking up at the Temple Mount saying, "This will happen there," as you're looking at it. And her words to me, it was like a light went on. And she suddenly said, "No, I'm going straight home. I'm going to read my Bible. I'm going to read my Bible." And I think there's going to come a time when, yes, they go back in unbelief. But I think the Jewish people are going to turn, aren't they? They're going to. Do you feel that they're going to turn? And through the events that you've already just been speaking about, through these events, they are going to find themselves face to face with their God. Mm-hmm. And that they're going to have to sort of be confronted with, do I believe this or not?
Absolutely. I'd like to make two comments on that. First of all, you talking about the events that would occur to this Jewish woman and prompting her to be excited to go pick up her Bible is the role of the church, according to Deuteronomy 32, verses 21. Mm. We are to provoke the Jews to jealousy. In other words, how do you know so much about my God Jehovah and the messianic prophecies about Jesus and things like that and the Messiah? How do you know that? Well, of course, we as Christians, we're in the Word of God and we want to learn these things. So this woman is now wondering, you know, "I'm jealous. I want to know what he wants to know." So that we're not to provoke them to anger, which has happened so much, or to fear. But to provoke them to jealousy. Yeah. And you fulfilled an important role there. We also know that the Jews, according to Romans 11, are partially hardened, partially blinded until the fullness of the Gentiles come in. And then it says in other passages in the New Testament that all Israel will be saved. There will be a faithful remnant of Jewish people who will come out of the tribulation period, who will come to recognize that Jesus is the Messiah. And they will do this, and we're told in Hosea 5:15, it says, "I return to my place," referring to the Messiah. Well, we know Jesus has returned to the right-hand side of God presently. Mm. And in their affliction, he says, they will recognize their offense, and they will beckon my return. In other words, their offense would be generational rejection of Jesus as the Messiah. So in their affliction, in the tribulation, they will call for him to come back and say, "Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord," and he will return for them in the second coming.
Right. Why do you believe Israel is one of God's greatest miracles? I mean, then coming in the car, you said greater than the parting of the Red Sea, and I agree. But would you like to tell folks why you believe it is one of God's greatest miracles, the rebirth of the state of Israel?
Well, yeah, I think we can elaborate upon what I said in that if we're talking about God bringing Jews from the nations of the world into the land of Israel, that's no minor undertaking. You know, parting of the Red Seas, he had them all in one place, and he had to part Red Seas, which, of course, you know, no one can do that but God, and he had to protect them from the Egyptian army, and, of course, he had to enclose those seas on the Egyptian army. But what we're talking about, bringing them out of the nations of the world through a Holocaust condition, well, let's look at that for a second. What sovereign events did God have to do that? You know, first of all, to bring the Jews in, back into the Holy Land required that the Holy Land be cleared of its dominance of the Ottoman Empire. And that happened in 1917. They had ruled over there for 400 years. Then it required to prevent the Nazi genocide, empowering the Allies to stop Hitler from successfully destroying all the Jews so that he could have Jews to bring back into the land.
Yeah.
Okay. Then it required putting a Zionistic inclination on the hearts of Jewish people to want to even come back to a land that was, you know, wasn't the most best tourist attraction in the world at that time. I mean, then it required that there would have to be Arab states formed, because at the time a lot of the Arabs were living in that area. So, of course, we know after World War I, the Arab states, and World War II, of course, they started to form. You had Egypt in 1922. You had Saudi Arabia and Persia was in 1935. You had Syria and Jordan in 1946. I mean, all the states started to form in that window period of time. Then he had to legislate an Israeli state, the state of Israel, through the United Nations.
Right.
I mean, these are big sovereign events, and presently he has to preserve them from Arab wars, just so that he can still continue to create Aliyah. And he's going to prosper them, because we know that when they get invaded by Russia, they're a wealthy nation.
Yes.
So, I mean, I don't see the United Nations being able to accomplish all those feats. I see this. I see God's fingerprints all over this. And you know, if you think about it, I've studied this. Ethnic groups who have been outside of their homeland for more than 400 years have never survived.
Right.
The Jews were out of their homeland for 1,878 years and survived and are coming back into Israel. And the Bible foretold that when they came back into Israel, they would meet with Arab resistance. And what do we see today? Arab resistance.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So, if we believe now fingerprints of God are all over this, why is it so many Christians who you meet just don't seem to believe it, don't want to know about it? It goes over their head. I mean, I travel around the country speaking, and I get Christians come up to me at the end of meetings and say, well, my church, I'm sure you have the same, my church doesn't teach this. How come I've never heard about this? How come I've never heard about end times Bible prophecy? I never knew Israel was supposed to be part of God's prophecy. I thought it was the church now. I thought God had finished with Israel. How do you answer that to perhaps somebody who's looking in who says, my church has never taught this?
And you're right. I get that same thing every time I talk. Inevitably, someone comes up and says, I've not heard about the relevance of Israel. My church doesn't teach Bible prophecy. You know, a third of the Bible, for all intents and purposes, is devoted toward Bible prophecy. There's 31,173 passages in the Bible. That means about 10,000 passages are prophetic in their nature. And you're right. And they're not understanding the relevance of Israel today. And in so doing, they're not giving God the full glory he deserves for the sovereignty I've just expressed.
Yeah.
And they're denying themselves of a very valid witness so they can bring people into the kingdom.
Yeah.
I think the culprit for this really goes way back around the 3rd and 4th century, when you have this doctrine of replacement theology coming into the church.
Right.
You know, Augustine, Bishop of Hippo back then, and then Oregon, he started allegorizing prophecy. He made it seem as if you were mature if you didn't take prophecy literal, but you really understood the deeper allegorical meanings.
Right, sure.
And pretty soon, you know, the Jews were out of the land for quite a bit of time. It justified their thinking that, well, you know, God must be done with the Jew. They rejected Jesus. God's rejected them. Now the church must be the Israel. So today we've got the church predominant. Some people say it's 70 to 85% of the church subscribes to replacement theology, meaning that God is done with the Jew. Now, I don't believe that 70 to 85% of the church even knows what replacement theology is. I just think that so many people are inadequately taught about Israel and its relevance. And that's why it's important programs like this go out there so people can, oh, really, were there prophecies that talked about this? Is it even possible that God's fingerprints are all over Israel today? And if they inquire and do their own research, I think it becomes undeniable. undeniable that Israel today is a miracle of God. It's very important that people understand that Israel is God's timepiece, and we're living in the last days. And we have events that are foretold that are going to come soon and sequentially that are going to adversely affect all of humanity. We're going to have Israeli war prophecies that are going to come, I believe, very soon. And we're seeing this in the news presently. These things are stage setting. Turkey alienating itself from Israel. And trying to prop up the Hamas plight. And they're the representative government of the Palestinians. Hamas is in Bible prophecy. There would be Philistia in Psalm 83.
Yeah.
Palestinians referred to as the tents of Edom. They would be in Psalm 83. Turkey's in Ezekiel 38. So, I mean, you know, it really, I'm hoping that we can pique an interest in Christians to open their scriptures and check these things out and look at the commentaries and stuff.
I mean, I've spoken to Christians who just, it goes over their head.
Mm-hmm.
They just don't believe it. The argument I sometimes use is, you know, you've been grafted in. Paul says, you are grafted in to Israel, into their vine.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if God's purpose for Israel is dead and gone, so is that covenant.
Mm-hmm.
So what are you grafted into?
Right.
You're grafted into something that's dead.
Right.
You're grafted into a dead covenant.
Mm-hmm.
Either that covenant is alive, and you're grafted into a living covenant where God is promising to bless Israel, or he's finished with them, and you're grafted into absolutely nothing.
Absolutely, and that's a good way to look at that. You know, we're told in, I think it's Romans 15:27,
mm-hmm.
that we are partakers of that covenant, not overtakers.
Yes.
We're partakers. And that we are grafted in Romans 11, it brings that up. And this is a serious issue, Bob, because if Christians really analyze what they're thinking, if they think if God is done with Israel, we have to now question God's ability to save us as Christians. Because we rely on the fact, according to Ephesians 2, verses 8, that we're saved by grace through faith, not of ourselves. It's a gift of God. Not by works, lest any man should boast. We trust God to deliver upon that gift of our salvation through his grace.
Yes.
Now, we need a promise-keeping God. That's a promise to us.
That's right.
And so we have to look back at, what are the promises of God made? We look at the Genesis 12, verses 3, promised Abraham he'd be a great nation. He went on in Genesis 13, 15 and said Abraham would have people, descendants forever.
Mm.
He went on in Genesis 15, 18 and gave him a large chunk of land. We call it the Holy Land, the promised land today. And he's got promises. He promised him a king. You pick it up in 2 Samuel. David was that, but we also have an eternal king.
Yes.
Luke 1 talks about verses 32 and 33, and that would be Jesus.
Yes.
We have a new covenant mentioned in Jeremiah 31, where God he replaces the old Mosaic covenant by writing his spirit, his law upon our hearts and minds.
Mm.
That's called the new covenant. That's what we're grafted into. These are promises that made to the Jewish people. So if all of a sudden God is done with the Jew, the logical conclusion would be he's not a promise keeper. His covenant-making character has flaws. And of course we know better than that. So for us to see one Jew alive in this world means that God is still keeping his promise to Abraham. It went through Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He had 12 sons of 12 tribes of Israel. And it extrapolates on down through modern-day Israel today. So it's a very significant matter to get your Israelology right and to understand the importance of Israel today.
That's a very good answer, Bill.
Mm.
Thank you for that. I'm sure that's clarified a lot. So what should my attitude as a Christian be toward Israel? Mm. Should we support the Israeli government? Should we not? What should my attitude be toward Israel as a Christian?
Well, as a Christian, I mentioned it earlier, you do have a very important role. We do have a very important role, according to Deuteronomy 32. We are to provoke the Jew to jealousy.
Mm.
They need to have a hunger for God, just like we have a hunger for God, to learn his word and to know what's going on and have a relationship ultimately with Jesus Christ. So we are still here on this earth. We have not been raptured. And one of our primary roles is to provoke the Jews to jealousy. Paul, wherever he went, he always went to the synagogues first to preach the gospel.
Yes.
We need to get the gospel out. Romans 1:16, I believe it is, says to the Jew first. We got to get the gospel out to the Jew. We have a very significant role for Israel. From a compassionate side, as a Christian, we have to have concerns for the Jewish people. Like I said earlier, they're living under an existential threat. Genocidal attempts have occurred throughout their history. Psalm 83 is going to be another one. Ezekiel 38 and 39 is going to be another one. And then if that's not bad enough, the Armageddon campaign, we're told in Zechariah 13 that two-thirds of the Jewish people will be cut off in the land. So we're talking about some really tough times for the Jewish people. Christians should have a real sincere heart and compassion for them. We are grafted into them. Salvation is to the Jew and the Gentile,
right,
not just to the Gentile.
Amen.
So it's very important that we understand we have to love our Jewish brothers, get the gospel out to them, and ultimately that's going to have a very positive effect because it says all Israel will be saved